Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And Dr. Redmond.
And we are here on, sadly, our second last episode about The Inside. I don't know how. I mean, we've been talking about this all week, but how do we go back to Criminal Minds after this? You know? Well, I mean, I know for anyone listening to this who listens to the Criminal Minds episodes as well knows that we have already successfully gone back to Criminal Minds. But in the moment, in an intensive 5-day period of just mainlining and podcasting about every single episode of The Inside, it feels weird to imagine going back. You know? It really does.
Oh, and shall I say that I watched Little Girl Lost.
Yep.
And I phoned you.
Yeah.
And I think I've calmed down a little bit. But I'm going, sometimes I think we're a little too hard or you're a little too hard on Criminal Minds. And then I watched Little Girl Lost and I went.
And you see Garrett Dillahunt.
Right? Yeah. Well, it's okay that Garrett Dillahunt, and it's okay because he's an actor and he does jobs and he's in lots of things.
Oh,
I don't care that they hired Garrett Dillahunt for a role in Criminal Minds. In fact, a two-parter. He's really good. That's not my problem.
Nope.
My problem is that not only, right, do they crib, like what this Little Girl Lost episode just, not only do they crib and not well always.
Yeah.
Storylines, everything else, and then we'll get into character, no less. But not only this, when they get Garrett Dillahunt in, it's like, oh, well, he had a mentally handicapped brother
in that episode of The Inside.
So I guess that's what we're going to do in this one.
I know. It's crazy.
Or
who thought you would see that connection?
Who wrote the script?
Yeah, I did not check.
And somebody looked, oh, I can't remember. I mean, I'm sure I have it.
No, but someone looked it over and they're like, oh, I remember. We were just watching that episode of The Inside. And the guy with the mentally challenged brother was Garrett Dillahunt. Maybe we can get him for this.
Yeah. You know, like, I'm going, I don't know which way it went.
It probably went that way. The way Hollywood usually works is you write a part and then you look for someone who has already played that exact part.
Except that the characters that Garrett Dillahunt play in these two things are different.
Oh, completely different. But again, you know, serial killer with a mentally challenged brother. Like, they just went to the guy they had just seen doing that. Because obviously Criminal Minds is aware of The Inside.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't have. Yeah, you know, it's just like, what?
I know. I agree. Know. It's crazy.
I mean, you call them hacks all the time. I put up season 2 on Amazon Kindle. Right. So I just started working on season 3 as well, you know, and I don't know how many times you call them hacks, but
they are.
I'm going, we're too hard in them. And then I look at something like this and I just go, no, these guys have no imagination.
Yep.
Maybe none of them have got abusive backstories. And that's why they can't get there.
Who knows?
Who knows?
Okay, here's another fun thing, though. Did you notice who was playing Garrett Dillahunt's dad?
Yeah, what's his face?
From the episode where Aaron wants to beat that guy to death.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was nice, right? I never remember that actor's name. And he was, of course, the... Hank's boss on Breaking Bad as well. He's done a lot of good work for a lot of years. But yeah, I thought it was great that he showed up. I totally forgot he was ever on the show. It was nice.
Yeah, no. I mean, no. And I have, you know, it's like watching all of these different people is really nice. You know, mm-hmm. I always like to see, after all, we get in The Perfect Couple, we get Amber Benson.
I know. Wasn't that great?
Wasn't that nice?
I'm seeing Amber Benson again.
Yeah, and we get the guy who played Jekyll.
Yep. But for now, we'll stick to this episode. For now, we'll focus on this episode because it's another episode where you don't know where it's going right from the start. We got a kidnapped family.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We got a kidnapped family locked in a mine. She's figured out she has been once again triggered by the idea of kidnapping, because it's the most personal crime for her.
Yeah.
Right? So she's freaked out, and she has decided she's going to fix this case. And as a consequence, she has been up for 36 hours when we find her at the beginning of the episode. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, no, she's at 36 when we find her, and by the time the helicopter crashes, she's been up for 2 days.
Yeah.
But when we first meet her in the episode, she's already been up for 36 hours. It's really bad. You know, she is in terrible shape, and she has to figure out, you know, and she has figured out that there's very few people this could have been. And then you have just a scene that shows you why this show is so much better than every other show like it.
Yeah.
Which is, you get the scene that we see in every Criminal Minds episode where they go to the police station and they meet the police people and start talking about the case, except the team already knows who the killer is.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating.
And they arrest him during the meeting the local cops scene. And that's the thing. It's like, you see a scene like that, you're like, where the hell is this episode going?
Yeah. Well, no, it's even though, I mean, it's right from the beginning. Let's just get from to the beginning, right? Because not only has she been up 36 hours,
yeah,
right, but she falls asleep.
Yes.
And then she dreams. But it's very interesting that it's in Webb's office that she goes.
Not only she has cast the guy who kidnapped her as Webb in her dream.
Yeah.
It's like
fascinating. It was a fascinating. So she goes,
great
in
use
there,
of a dream and, sequence. And it's not commented on in the episode. It's just like, no, we're going to do the scene exactly like we would with Webb, except mm-hmm. it's going to be the man that kidnapped you.
Mm-hmm.
That's an impressive choice.
And he's going to be creepier, of course.
Than Webb. Course he's creepier.
But you're going, I mean, it's to her, and I'm going, okay. Like, the thing is you, in your head, you're always going, well, where are they going to go with this? Because, like, it just gives you this little glimpse of this guy, because we already know who he mm-hmm. is. But you're missing something, and he keeps flipping over these cards. Like, she yep. shows them the cards, right? And then he flips over a couple of them, and now they've changed. It's an interesting, and then she goes, oh, yeah. And she says, well, I'm going to, and she phones Webb right away.
Yep.
Right?
At the conclusion. And I love that it's like, you got this message of just, and it's something that comes up in the episode. Just look at these guys. No one would pull over their car and talk to these guys. Like, you know, no one seeing that, even if someone was pretending their car was broken down, like, no one would see that guy standing next to a broken car in the middle of the night with your family in the car with you and say, yeah, I'm going to stop and check on these weirdos.
Yeah, no. You'd go into the next police station and say there's a car broken down.
Oh, there's a car stopped on the side of the road there. You know, and that's what you would do. Or, I mean, if you have a cell phone, you'd call it in with a cell phone. But no one's stopping to talk to these guys. There's no way. And that's what she realizes when she's looking at the pictures of these guys. Sometimes you can judge a book by its cover. And that's what she says when she's talking to Garrett Dillahunt. The only reason a family would stop driving through a creepy forest in the middle of the night is because a cop stopped them.
No, but what's the beauty of, like, the beauty of this whole thing is that you don't get, like you're sort of jumping ahead.
I'm jumping ahead one scene, you know.
No, but what happens is she says, okay, I have to get there. And remember, she's driving, she shouldn't have been driving a car.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Because she's sort of falling asleep at the wheel. And then she cranks up the music. I'm going, I've been there. Right, so she's and she sees again her kidnapper on the road,
yeah,
right, and almost has a car accident because of it. Because mm-hmm. you know, so she's having sort of a quasi dream sequence, almost, and so she gets there, and then they just set up the entire perp walk or the
all as a ruse to distract. Yeah. All is a ruse to distract Garrett Dillahunt.
Yeah, and it's hilarious watching, because you don't really see it coming.
No, you don't at all. Even though you see Garrett Dillahunt and you know he's a famous actor, or at least famous character actor, you don't immediately see it coming.
No, because Because there's Adam Baldwin yakking away to him about guns. And,
I know.
And saying, oh, well, let me see your gun compared. Yeah, yours is bigger than mine. You know, bigger isn't always better. That's what we all say, right?
He makes the fallacy joke.
And then neither of the guys get it. And nobody gets it.
He gets this hilarious joke.
That's a fallacy.
That nobody gets. And he's just staring at them like, really? Like, nothing?
Really? You don't get this, right? And then it turns out, of course, this
it was just all a scam to get the gun away from Garrett Dillahunt so they could arrest him. Oh, yeah.
It was just like...
It's a beautiful scene. And
it's a beautiful little scene there.
Well, no, and the thing is, it's interesting you point out that she drives there. She doesn't ask somebody to drive her because, again, she's very self-possessed and she does want to do things for herself. Even though, let's face it, she really should have someone driving her. She's been up for 36 hours and she knows that. And I've never been up for 36 hours, but it is a commonly reported side effect of that you can have mild hallucinations. Probably not the kind she suffers in the episode, but then again, she doesn't have really bad hallucinations until she also has a head injury on top of it, so I think we're going to let them get away with that.
Well, no, the hallucinations, though, they're dreams. Like, she's not having a hallucination because she wakes up. You see her after she saw Webb in the office, like her.
Yes. Oh, no, I should have made it clear, right?
And then
when she sees him and the little girl in her quote unquote awake, what can happen? It's not really hallucination. It's that momentarily when people are that tired, they have like micro dreams where they fall asleep for half a second, right?
Yeah.
And they are essentially dreaming without realizing they're asleep. And that is what sleep deprivation hallucinations are like. It's not like schizophrenic hallucinations and auditory hallucinations.
You're
dreaming for a half a second.
She's fallen asleep.
She's fallen asleep while walking around and talking to people. She's still falling asleep because that's how tired she is.
So anyway, so they get in the helicopter crashes.
Yep.
Because Garrett Dillahunt has agreed, right, mm-hmm. that he will show them where the family is.
Is locked away, right, if they go easy on him.
Yeah, if they go easy on him. And so, okay, and then so you get Ryan and she's in the helicopter with Garrett Dillahunt.
And Adam Baldwin,
right? Mm-hmm. And then the Ryan is in, and Mel
the other
in
helicopter.
The other helicopter, right? Or Mel? No, Mel stays behind.
No, Mel's at home. It's Ryan and Webb in the other helicopter. Or no, I don't think Webb
no,
goes
no.
in the helicopter.
No,
but it doesn't
he doesn't
really,
go in the
it,
helicopter.
It doesn't matter who's in the other helicopter
because
they're not
they
part of
to,
the story.
They go to visit the family.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But they'd already made that comment. Well, you know, he's got and then he's got this handicapped son at home, at which point I went, oh, good Lord.
You can't help but see the Criminal Minds connection.
No,
yeah,
not just immediately. And then I'm going, but anyway, and then I let that slide. But then they go to the family, they meet the parents, right? And then it's interesting how Webb does it. Well, let's hope that gets, because the mother clearly knows where this family probably is.
Oh, she knows right away, and she'll do anything to protect her son.
Yeah, so... So that's that arc of the story. But then she.
Well, no, and that's a nice scene because they specifically say, right? He specifically tries to get the family as angry and nervous as possible in the hopes that one of them will do something, that one of them will try and reach out to the son. And it turns out to be the mother, which isn't a huge surprise.
No.
Because, you know, she sees herself as on her kid's side against this monster of a husband, but she hasn't really protected them at all.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, they have been so horribly abused that he has formulated a serial killing, you know, MO that is built around proving that there's no such thing as a happy family. You know, so, yeah, it's very specific, and they're like, no, they tied the crime he commits. Again, if you ever wonder if the show thinks that abuse, you know, like, childhood abuse is what causes these murders, like, no, there's no hesitation. Like, over and over again, that's what the message is of this, of these episodes. It is the stuff that happens to these people when they're kids that makes them do this. It's going to come up again in The Perfect Couple, right? Because they don't delve into her background, but it's there. And here, the show explicitly says, the way that his father treated him not only turned Garrett Dillahunt into a killer, but even formed the kind of killing he was doing in the same way that D. Claude said that. Like, the specific molestation and physical abuse of his mother 100% designed both his target and the kind of crimes he committed.
Yeah.
In D. Claude. So, yeah, it's... Oh, God, it's interesting.
But, yeah, and then, I mean, they even do the whole thing with her sequence with Garrett Dillahunt as, because, of course, she's still alive. They're all still alive. I don't know about the pilot, but they get into
the pilot. No, they specifically said the pilot does not survive.
Yeah, and he misses, but they're fighting. But he couldn't have done anything anyway.
Like, yeah, of course.
The fact that they're fighting doesn't cause the helicopter to crash.
Oh, no, no. It is just a bad turn for everybody.
It's just a thing, but they have the fighting thing, and then they go down.
And that's so, the thing. It's like they try to be as not contrived as possible because, let's face it, it's not a terrible crash. Like, there's an engine failure. You switch to auto-rotate. But the problem is, if there's no place to put the helicopter, if you're losing control of the helicopter and there's no place to flat to put it down, it's going to crash.
Yeah.
You know, it's like everybody does the best they can, but there's no place to put it down. And so while they're trying to bring it in for a landing, it hits a tree and it crashes because it would have to. There's no place to land. The other helicopter, there's no clear place to put it down.
Yeah. And so they end up about half a mile away.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. So, I mean, it's and then you see, right? It's fascinating how in her head, right? Like, and it was so well done.
Brilliantly, like, well done, because you don't. And I mean, we're being so coy about this, like people haven't seen the episode. No, it's not the little girl from the hole. She's remembering herself as a child, and the entire episode, like she thinks that only by becoming like her killer, her
kidnapper,
can she be strong enough? Like, all of her, does all of her being self-possessed come from the fact that she was kidnapped? And the episode is entirely about these two parts of her persona, the innocent girl that she was and this monster that took her, right?
Yeah.
And the message of the episode winds up being, no, the little girl he took, he didn't turn her into a monster. There was strength in her, and she rescued herself.
But I think what's really interesting, right? What, like, so many interesting things in that part, in all of that. Yeah, that's the end of the episode.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we have to assume everybody's watched it. But for me,
of course,
the really interesting part is this, how he keeps telling her and explaining to her how he's going to get this little girl's
trust,
trust, right? And what he's going to do. And so she's repeating all of the things he did. And in some ways, she's learning that, okay, I got sucked in big time. And even her leaving her badge was good, you know, and then Garrett Dillahunt, like, I knew he wasn't dead, but she's like, because his eyes were moving, right?
He'd
been knocked out, but his eyes were moving. And
but it's not like she was in a position, she wasn't psyched to choke a man to death. She wasn't psyched to choke a man to death.
Well,
he went down.
Wasn't.
That was enough for her. And she was like, I got to rescue this little girl. I mean, she is so out of her mind with a concussion and tiredness at that point.
Yeah.
It's one of the rare situations where you 100% accept that, like, because any other cop show, if she choked a guy and then didn't secure him in any meaningful way, I would be calling, you know, oh, that's crap. But on this episode, she's having visions of herself as a child and thinks there's a kid she has to rescue. She is, like, she's been up for 2 days at this point, and she was just in a helicopter crash. No, she is not thinking straight. He's not moving. He doesn't seem to be breathing. Of course, she just assumes she's dead. Again, we've seen television. We know he's coming back. But, you know, like, you totally, they get the character to a place where she makes a bad assumption and it causes problems, but they totally earn it by the circumstance that has led to it.
Yeah. It's totally and completely believable that she thinks she's choked him to death.
Yeah.
No, she just, but that's okay. I would say even that she wasn't strong enough to choke him to death at that point.
Well, it doesn't matter if you're strong enough. If you drag back with your wrists for 10 minutes, he's going to die eventually.
Never mind. Yeah. Never mind. That's not important. Yeah. Because it's fully believable. And then of course he's following her and she's got the little girl and she's trying to persuade the little girl. Everything's going to be okay. It is just
the journey her subconscious takes her on in this episode is so fantastic because it's like, he's a grown ass man who understands how people think. Of course you trusted him. Of course you didn't know not to believe him. Of course you didn't realize he was a predator, right? And the thing is, it's like she is using like this thing, like in the way that she's teaching herself, and it is weird because it's she's teaching herself how to deal with the younger version of her. It's letting herself off the hook in a sense for being tricked by him.
Well, no, yeah, and no, and what we find out about her character is that one of the reasons she feels so guilty is not just that she gave him her address, but that she willingly went with him.
Yep.
Out of her bedroom, right?
Yeah. She didn't scream, she didn't kick.
No, he probably promised her that the horse was out in the backyard, you know, something like that. And so she went with him.
Yep.
And you know, so that makes her personal guilt about being kidnapped and her responsibility
all the more
about
intense,
being kidnapped.
Yeah.
All the more intense, and it also explains why she blocked. It's not just that she set the fire, it's that she
blames herself for her own abduction.
For her own abduction because she went with him, right? And so, like, it's all there. Plus, remember that we do not know, and I did not know, it was only sort of at the end when she's going to go meet the family, and I thought, oh, shit.
Yeah,
you know, it was. I did not know that was not the little girl because we do see the father trying to get the little girl
out at the beginning.
The shaft.
Yeah,
and she can't. But we don't know. Like,
we don't know
what
happened, and we don't see what the little girl looks like. Yeah,
no. So we have no idea. So and we
well, no, and I mean, the first time I watched it, I will remember the moment I realized. And the thing is, the episode is done so well that you don't realize it, right? The first time I watched it, right, the moment I realized what was going on, and it took me this long the first time I watched it, was the moment the little girl helps her shoot Garrett Dillahunt, I realized that, oh, okay, this is entirely metaphorical. Okay.
You know why? It's because the episode paces itself so well, you don't have time to think
exactly.
About it.
No, exactly. You're totally right about that.
Exactly the same point when I said,
okay, I see what's happening here.
There. When she shoots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's only for a moment. And the thing is, the camera moves up. The camera moves up. So you don't even really think about the fact that I feel like I should still be able to see the little girl in that shot.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's your
it's
first.
So,
but
it's subtle. Yeah.
Because
it's,
you know,
beautifully
she
shot
shoots,
and subtle.
They're going to hear.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to hear. And they're going to find her because they're going to hear the gunshot and they're just going to go toward.
And
the
they immediately cut as she shoots Garrett Dillahunt. They cut to them hearing the gunshot and rushing over.
Yeah.
Like it's all done perfectly, but it's not until the little girl helped her shoot Garrett Dillahunt that I'm like, okay, this is 100% metaphorical. Like this is her young self. Being strong, like being able to be strong and stand up for herself in the same way that she rescued herself from the pony man originally.
Right? Yeah,
that's what we're watching. But the episode is so well done that you're not looking for that the whole way through.
You're not looking for that. You don't even think that. And then,
then
it's only at that point that you go, oh yeah. And then they immediately cut. And then they immediately cut and to the hospital, right?
Yep.
Like they cut to Ryan.
Yeah, because
so
once Garrett Dillahunt is dead, she can finally sleep.
Yeah. So she sleeps. She's got her arm in a sling. And then they see her going in to see Baldwin. And then, you know, Webb comes and says, the family would like to thank you. And
then you get the payoff.
Because she still doesn't know.
Of course she
does. That little girl isn't her.
Is her.
I mean, is her. Yeah.
Yeah.
She doesn't know. She still thinks it's the little girl. And so she meets the little girl and looks at her and goes.
And she gets this moment of, oh, right. And then just to figure out what was happening, we get the moment. Just in case the audience is a little slow. And I know they have to put this in. But just in case the audience is a little slow, they actually have her go in reading the newspaper article at the end.
Well, and they said. Yeah, no, but she goes and looks at her file. And they set that up right at the beginning. Where
yeah, talking about her file.
He says, you've been here for 2 years. You have access to your file, and you haven't looked at it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
You know?
But it's like you can't deny that it's that's you can't deny that that scene is there just in case someone in the audience didn't get it.
Yeah. And I think, oh, for sure. Oh, no, I agree. But it's bookended perfectly.
Oh, no. And, I mean, it's, and as you say, it doesn't feel like a reshoot. It feels like right from the moment they were conceptualizing the episode, they thought, okay, there's a chance someone in the audience isn't going to get this. So let's talk about her file at the start of the episode so we can justify, completely organically justify her looking at the file at the end of the episode.
Yeah. Yeah, and it makes
total sense,
and it works from beginning to end, and even because people could miss. Look, like you saw it,
yeah.
Right when the girl is saying, "Let me help you with the gun."
Yeah,
right, and so the little girl is holding the gun. Now, what happens, of course, but you don't really see it, is that it fades in, like the little girl fades into her, and it's just her with the gun shooting.
Oh, yeah, and then it's just her with the gun shooting, yeah.
But people can easily miss that. That
exactly. No, no, I'm not judging the people who might have missed it. I'm saying it's smart that they put in that scene for the people who might have missed it. I'm saying they understand that sometimes their audience needs a little more explanation.
Well, particularly, and as I said, particularly in this case, because...
Yeah, when it's done this well, yes.
When it's done this well, because that's the only, that's the first time I went, oh, but where's the little girl?
Yeah.
And then I didn't have time to really think it through.
No, because
like,
again, but that's just, that's the pacing. That's, I mean, we're talking every week about how incredibly well-paced these episodes
are. Yeah, just perfectly well, so that... And so that's just to make, but, and then everybody can figure, technically everybody figures it out when you see what the girl looks like.
Of course, yeah.
Right? And then you say, oh shit, so that must have been, she was hallucinating herself as a child.
Yeah.
You know?
And again, the thematic resonance of that though, it is so great that it's like, no, it wasn't the murderer that made you strong. You may have learned tricks from him. You may have learned how to manipulate from him. You may have learned how to pretend from him. But the strength to get away with from him didn't come from him. It didn't come from that this bad thing happened to you. Like, there are so many skills you have. The manipulation, the learning to get people to trust you, the tricking. That, yeah, that came from your experience. But the strength was yours.
Yeah.
You and killed him, and you can kill Garrett Dillon. That's because it's not the delusion of her kidnapper that helps her kill Garrett Dillon.
No, no.
It's her. And that's beautiful.
Because you can see her. Because you can see her resisting taking his advice.
Yeah. Oh.
Right?
It's like such a good way. It is such a good way to dig into her psyche.
Yeah. No, it was so good. And I think, I mean, there are such... Bizarrely, I would say there are some really good messages in here.
Oh,
right?
Totally.
That I'm going, you know, like I think back too, you know, like I have at times talked about myself when I was 8 years old, right?
Yeah.
Like there's this person, like there's a reason when it's later. I've talked usually about the fact that when it's later, you don't have, you never create, as I said, you know, you don't create your brain no longer can split itself off.
Yes.
Because you're older. And this is the same thing for her. She's 10 years old when she's kidnapped. So she has already formed.
The core personality stuff that keeps her from getting DID. Yeah.
Yeah. Right? So she doesn't get DID.
The way she would have had she been abducted at 5 or 6.
Or 4, yeah.
Or 4 even, yeah.
Or 5 or 6 even, yeah. You know, that what when it happens to you later, you've got a core personality structure, and with any luck, and she came from a, you know, a strong
enough
family,
house, yeah.
A happy enough, as I did, You know, so you have this core that knows somehow or another right and wrong. Mm-hmm. Now you blame yourself for a lot more than you should.
Of course.
But that's the way it goes. And they did this, they did it so well just looking at this. You know, this again, this is another one. The story is good, like the kidnapping that they're gonna hang this character revelation on. Like the story is still good. Garrett Delahunt is great.
He's great as always. I mean, it's Garrett Delahunt. He's fantastic.
I think he's better here. Yeah, he's really good.
And he's even better here than he was on Criminal Minds. But then again, he's got a better script to work with.
Yeah.
And like, the plot of this episode of Criminal Minds is so ludicrous.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's exactly it. And there's nothing ludicrous about this.
No, this all feels
true. And it works. Yeah. It feels very, very true. And so I'm...
I just want to say... how impressed I was again with the show for having her, like, because we've talked a lot about Webb's motives, right? And what Webb wants and who Webb is. And I was so impressed by the way the show, because it has never had her come out and question Webb the way Paul sometimes does, or even Melody sometimes does, right?
Yeah.
But just the fact that she cast her kidnapper as Webb in her dream means that this character, on board as she is with everything Webb's doing, deeply distrusts him down at the core. Like, there's a part of her subconscious where she sees how dangerous Webb is.
Yeah. And she said it at the end of
the episode, exactly. But, oh, so smart. Such a smart way to handle that, to let us... To give us, I mean, how rare is it that you get a dream sequence that does this much to, and like, even, let you into characters' heads, right?
Yeah, and using the tarot card thing was really, like, that whole thing, yeah, to get into her head, because she's probably not truly, totally conscious
of course
either
no.
of her distrust of Webb.
No, she's not.
And why, you know? So, it's
amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing, and we know it. But anyway, so let's move on to our second episode. But again, just yet another truly full-out great episode of The Inside.
Yep.
A show that basically only does great episodes, except for the two episodes that are only just good. Sorry, very good. All right, next up, we have The Perfect Couple.
This was... An interesting, horrendous.
Oh, it's horrible.
Episode, yeah.
We get another great Webb moment from the end of the episode. We'll talk to that in a second. We'll talk about that in a second. First off, though, it opens with her out trying to lure in a killer, acting as bait. Again, the performance. Her life as performance, because how easily she goes in and out of these characters she plays.
Yeah.
Very well done. Reminds you what a really solid actress Rachel Nichols is. Like, she's really good. She's so good. Well, the weird part is, if you were, like, if you didn't know the show, if you didn't know, like, what she looks like, blah, 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 there's a chance you would watch that first scene set in the bar and not realize it was Rebecca.
Well, no, you know what I thought?
Yeah.
You know what I initially thought? Like, I thought, is that Rebecca? And then I thought, well, maybe they found someone who looks like Rebecca.
To make a point Rebecca? For a scene or...
No. And so that Rebecca is going to actually have to play her later
on. But it's just her. Right? Yeah.
You know, you're coming up. No, it was her.
It was her.
Yeah.
And but that's the thing that's so interesting about it.
100% sure.
Right away, because again, but she so transforms herself, not just with makeup, but with her performance.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, with her performance, she so transforms herself that you don't immediately think, oh, well, that's obviously Rebecca.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's pretty impressive. I think that's pretty darn impressive just as an actress.
Oh, yeah.
And just as a performance, it's great. So she goes up, she's like, she flirts with the, what do you call it? She flirts with the bartender.
Oh, and those scenes about being hit on in the bar, crap, I laugh. Oh, my God. Any woman who's ever been in a bar is looking at that scene and going, oh, I have been there.
This is all 100% true.
God, these guys that hit on you and their lines and their stupidity, right? Just because you're a woman sitting alone at a bar. Right?
Yep.
Heaven forbid. You've got to get, if you really don't want to, you have to kind of sit. You can't even do that in a bar. Or bring a book maybe to the bar, right? And you stick your face in the book, right?
Yeah. Woman alone in the bar is going to be constantly hit on. It's just a fact.
It's just like, oh, yeah.
So, I mean, there's a very true thing at the core of that, which is nice. But we find out that they're looking for a killer who brutally murders women by assaulting them, by kidnapping them, assaulting them, and then shooting them in the genitals with a shotgun.
Yeah.
Which, yikes. And we do the Criminal Minds thing of opening an episode with seeing a woman get brutally murdered. And you think, oh, are we going to do that again later? No, as usual, the episode has something much more interesting in mind. Like, every time I watch it, I'm like, are we going to go Criminal Minds? No, we don't. Never a middle victim to raise the stakes. And that is one of the things that impresses me about the show is, this show understands, no, the stakes are high enough.
Yeah.
The stakes are high. Women are being murdered. We don't need to see an extra woman getting murdered to raise the stakes. We understand the stakes. Give us a little credit.
We already have.
Both times an episode, but both times an episode has been structured like this. Woman gets killed at the start. We cut over to halfway through the episode, another victim turns up. This also happened in Aiden. Both times, those ladies survive and the episode takes an unexpected turn. And I mean, neither of them takes the same turn, right? Like they take two completely different unexpected turns. And then watching this series refuse to be formulaic really does make it once again stand out from the incredibly strict formula of Criminal Minds.
Yeah.
Where every single episode has to be exactly the same.
Yeah. And then everybody else in the episode, right, it's perfectly clear to everybody else that she's attracted to the bartender except her.
I know.
it's so funny. No, it can't be him. We've profiled him as the impotent. He's not.
That's so funny.
They do those things with, straight face, the whole thing, and you're just going, oh, yeah.
No, this show really has this history of doing comedy well. Well, just like last episode, Adam Baldwin's amazing joke that no one gets. Like, when this show decides to do comedy, it does it without breaking the tone of the show, and it's legitimately funny when it's doing it.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh. So anyway, so she does, she is attracted to a guy, and of course she has shut herself off from physical intimacy her whole life because of course she
Why
has.
Wouldn't she? Yeah.
No, she 100% we get it, but you know what? She's a full-grown woman. It's okay that she's attracted to this guy. She's just not comfortable with the fact that she's attracted to this guy.
Yeah.
It's really scary to her, again, completely understandably.
Yeah. And as she says to him, you know, and he agrees by the end of the episode, well, yeah, I don't know that I want your world.
Yeah. maybe I'm not cut out for this world of yours.
No.
Because
he listens to the whole thing that
well no, and the weird part is in a sense it's the kind of perfect guy for her because he really is a gentle, non-threatening guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like he really is, and it's like I could totally see this being the right guy for her in a different circumstance.
Yeah, you know, but you just and of course they do profile a male, but then it's like, okay, but they never see these women leaving with any men. They've gone through all of the video, the whole thing.
They expand their search.
You know, they go to the guy and he gives them some names and snob, you know, there's nothing. And it isn't until Yeah, I can't remember now. Isn't that funny? I can't remember what.
Yeah, what is the plot detail that makes them say it could be a woman? I'm blanking on that.
One of the women is bisexual.
Yes, one of them is just full on. A couple of the women had identified as bisexual, but they had only talked to their boyfriend, so they didn't think of it. And the last victim was full on a lesbian.
Yeah.
Yes, and, identified as lesbian and had an ex-girlfriend.
Yeah.
Yes, okay, and that's how Amber Benson lures her out. Yes, okay, we remembered. We got there. Well, no, yeah. And it's interesting that it was their assumptions about the kind of bar it was and the fact that they didn't dig deeply enough into the victims' lives that made them assume it was a man.
Yeah.
Right, so and, again, it was not a good assumption for them to make.
But they start looking for couples.
And then, because they immediately find Amber Benson, but they notice in the tapes that Amber Benson always seems to be looking for somebody, and they're like, okay, we know what's going on now. It's a couple. It's a good scene, and it gets you there in a very logical way. It gets you there in a very believable way, right? Like, you totally see how the characters made this link. And it's just by talking to the people involved, talking to the loved ones of the dead people, they find out enough about them to get there. Although, after they found out who Amber Benson is, I love that it's interesting because, like, once you've got this person's face and they don't, there's cameras everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, there's cameras everywhere. You can't keep your face hidden from a camera all the time. And so the minute they've got her face, okay, well, they know exactly what's going on. Or they think they do because they, they go and they grab Amber Benson as she's quote-unquote helping a woman escape from the guy and arrest her, and they just believe her story because it's what they want to do. Like, they want to assume. They've already heard this story about how her boyfriend is a monster who abuses her, forces her into three ways, like, sexually humiliates her. Like, the guy is a beast. He's a horrible monster, right? And so they naturally assume she's a victim too, and while that's accurate, she's also the killer.
Like, I'm going, and of course then she's filming and I'm just going, okay, so this was our horrible, you know. The funny thing is that when we watch the episode with Tony Bernardo or whatever his name is, right, the Criminal Minds episode that
Their fake Bernardo episode where turns out Carla Homolka was in charge. Bet you didn't see that coming, eh?
Well, no, but it's not even. Yeah, it's that whole thing. But when you look at this episode, you're going, okay, they must have watched this and figured, okay, how can we do this, you know, differently? Because in the other in the Homolka thing, I mean, nobody held the camera.
No, they always had a camera
set up because both of them were involved, right? And in here, you have, so they took that from this episode, the perfect couple.
It wouldn't
surprise
me. Yeah.
Yeah, no. I mean, after I watched these two episodes, I'm going, you know,
they were aware
mind,
of this show.
You can be as hard as you want on it because Lord only knows. And they made it more violent and they made it vicious and. Anyway, never mind. I want to get back to this episode because, I mean, how they, you know, and they have found that it's Roddy because, of course, the bartender knows. And then the bartender calls Rebecca. She doesn't answer the phone.
Yeah.
And he leaves a message and they don't get the message right away. Right. But they're still on Roddy's house.
Yeah.
So when Amber Benson or Tara takes her out. Right? It's Adam. Mm-hmm. But you don't know that it's Adam Baldwin following her.
I know. You think, is this part of their... You're like, is this part of the game? Does she pretend to run away and then he tracks them down and kills them? No, it's Adam Baldwin. How great is that moment?
Oh, my God. That was a great moment.
Oh.
Oh, my Lord.
And again, it's what this show's potential is. And that's what blows me away about this show. It has this potential to constantly surprise you. Like, it has this potential, like few other shows do, to take these turns that you don't see coming. And then so she runs home. And what I like about it is, right, so we get a little bit of Amber Benson, and we learn almost nothing about her backstory, except here's the key part. Here's how they met. He was a guy from a TV show.
Yeah.
And she was a woman who was stalking him. And they got together. Right? Because he so desperately needed someone to adore him. And she adored him. And you think, and it's like, how awful must her life have been wherever she was from?
Yeah.
That she moved out to Los Angeles to track down a guy from television.
Because she was a little girl when she was watching his child star.
Exactly. Because she was a child when she was watching his show. Because he was on like some high school themed show back in the 90s, which I'm going to have something to say about that in a minute, but I'm going to save it for the end of the episode. You'll understand why when I say it.
Yeah.
What's
his face? The redheaded kid from the Partridge Family.
Or, you know, Screech from Saved by the Bell. Something like that.
Yeah. Then she moves out to meet him and she stalks him. And of course his career has dumped down.
It's flattened out. So it's like, so he's got plenty of money. So now he just lives this idle, miserable life. And she turns his life around and gets him into shape and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Right.
And Zen, and they're the perfect couple. And
And then of course, you know, like, she immediately goes back, and the horrifying thing about her life is she immediately goes back to being horribly abused by the guy that she ran away to be with.
Like,
she must have been running away from abuse.
Yeah.
Right? And so she immediately starts being abused and controlled by the guy she ran away to.
Yeah, and then she runs away. She has a brief affair, and then she goes back to him with the bartender, and then she goes back to him, and of course, then he's going to make her pay.
Yeah, and he's going to make her pay by massively accelerating the horrible violence. He's definitely beating her, but B, making her participate in the rapes he's been fantasizing about forever.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Oh.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a rough episode, people.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the whole thing, because when he's beating this woman and everything, we don't see any of that.
Nope.
No, we just know it's happening, but we don't see any of it, right? Mm. And then you just see her in the morning because she's still awake and he's asleep, and so Amber Benson takes her away, and you know, and it's, yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and they've taped all of these things, and then they find out later on. Right.
When she
helps him escape, then, you know, and then we get that tour de force performance between the two of them.
That amazing scene. Yeah.
Oh, my Lord. And she's going, but I need something for myself.
I know.
You've got to give me the killing of these women, because he didn't know.
He had no idea what she was doing. Yeah, he just thought she was driving them home afterwards and telling them to keep their mouths shut, because he thought he was 100% control of Amber Benson, and all she could do, and this is how terrifying her life must have been, all she could do to remain in control was to murder the women he was attracted to afterwards.
Yeah.
Because he was attracted to them instead of her. Jesus!
Yeah.
Oh, God, this is a rough episode on fronts.
Yeah, well, he might beat her up, but he wasn't going to rape the woman that he was the Zen perfect couple with.
Of course, yeah.
You know?
Between those two actors, right, those, I don't remember the guy's name. I'm really embarrassed. I checked his name earlier, but now I've forgotten it. So I feel a little guilty about that. But the point is, between those two actors, Amber Benson and the male actor, it's just... just a dynamite scene.
Yeah.
Like, it's just an amazing scene between the two of them.
All of a sudden, oh, this can work, right?
Yes.
It's just this can work. And the first person that they're going to go and kill together is the guy she had the affair with, because that'll make him feel better.
I know. Oh. So perfect.
The poor
bartender.
Oh,
and then of course he almost gets killed because, you know, Rebecca doesn't bother picking up the phone when he calls and says that they've come to the club together.
Yeah. Yeah, I had thought that Roddy, you see, the funny thing is when Roddy comes up and talks to him, you think it's because he's on the phone to the FBI, but that's not why they had decided they were going to kill him.
Going to kill him, yep.
And then, because they're in this state and they want to do all of this stuff, and he says, I want to watch you beating him like I would beat the girls, you know, we're going to have this whole thing, right?
Yep.
And then, you know, but they figured it out. They go over.
And of course they write. Well, no, she hears once Rebecca hears the message from the bartender, of course she figures it out. She's very intelligent. Of course she's going to figure it out.
Yeah. So they go off. They do the hostage situation and Webb
and
goes
how
in.
Great is that hostage situation? Oh, because it leads to another classic Webb moment.
Yes, where he says,
well, and the thing is, he's like, we need right something from you. Oh, no, but we need something from you. And this is what I love. And it's like, well, what do you need from me? And it's like, let him, I have to come and negotiate with you in person. And they're like, fine, give us two hostages. But of course, knowing what they know about this woman's psychology, right?
Yeah.
All right. When he walks, he's like, I can get them. I know I can get them to turn on each other. And when he goes in and he sees that she's the one with the gun, he's like, oh, well, that's great. I can get her to shoot him.
Well, you can get him to say it was all her idea. I never killed
him. Oh, yeah, exactly.
Right?
Like, I can get him to turn on her.
Yeah.
And then boom, she'll shoot him. It's fine.
But it was his line at the end. Well, you finally shot the right one.
I know. She finally shot the right one. It's so beautiful.
You're sitting there going, holy shit.
Oh, you're such a monster, Webb, and we love you so much.
Because of it.
Oh, God. Yeah, they always give him the best lines. Oh, Peter Coyote. You're so good on this show.
Yep.
So, yeah, just an amazing episode. Another episode, and I mean, I hate to keep, you know, harping on this, but you have to. All of these episodes are about abused children. You know?
Yep. Yep.
They really are.
Because even Roddy is abused. If you know anything about what happens to children in
the entertainment industry, like he didn't come by these proclivities out of nowhere.
No.
No, he didn't. He's a screwed up person too. So now I'm going to say a thing that is going to be artistically stated to avoid getting us sued. So I'm going to give you some context first. All right. So remember how we were watching the show Action, right? And excuse me, Action is fantastic. You know, we were actually just talking literally last episode about how great Action is, because it comes up a lot when you're talking about Fox's insane cancellations. So there's an episode of Action about the Weinstein brothers.
Yeah.
And I mean, hell, Action, the entire character Ileana Douglas plays is a character who was abused as a child star and wound up becoming a sex worker.
Yeah.
An incredibly stable, you know, an incredibly stable sex worker. who sees the industry for what it is, but there's no doubt that she wouldn't be a sex worker today if she hadn't been a child star.
Yeah.
And the show makes that clear.
Yeah.
And when we were watching it back in the day, we're like, why on earth would Ileana Douglas ever want to stop playing this amazing character? She quit the show 10 episodes in. And now we know, because it brought up too much of what she went through with Les Moonves. Like, now we know that, but we didn't know that at the time, right? But apart from her stuff with Les Moonves, they did an episode about Weinstein. And that's an amazing episode. The episode about the Weinsteins is an amazing episode.
Oh my God.
It's brutally funny, and in retrospect, you realize, oh my God, it's clear that the people who were making the show were trying to let the audience know something about the Weinsteins and how they operated and the horrible stuff that was going on behind the scenes of these movies, right? And it just looked, because the whole show was this over-the-top grotesque satire of Hollywood, people weren't looking at the show to tell them something true, right?
Except
they weren't looking for Action to be whistleblowing on Hollywood, which is what it is.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I always said that.
Well, and fun fact, I mean, right now, there's this guy on the internet who is, who, and I, I don't, I mean, I'm not going to say it's my theory. The widely believed fact is this guy who has been doing all sorts of, you know, anonymous blog posts and putting out leaks and such about, you know, sex abusers throughout the film industry. Mm-hmm. People think that based on the people he's talked about and worked with, right? You know, based on the access to stories he had, people are like, this is probably Robert Downey Jr. And there's no confirmation. Yeah, and you can look this up online. Say, just type in, you know, is Robert Downey Jr. blowing the whistle on Hollywood pedophiles? And basically, people are like, because of his career, because of what he went through with drug abuse, being at it since he was a child, he knows all of these horrible stories. And he's so rich and powerful now that it's possible that he feels safe telling these stories, because if anyone finds out it's him, he'll be able to legally defend himself. Now, there's no confirmation that it is Robert Downey Jr. I'm saying that is what people are saying, and a bunch of the tips this guy has said about people have turned out to be true. I'm not saying it's all true. I'm not saying it's just one guy. It could be like one of those dummy accounts, right, who's just there to be a whistleblowing resource for a bunch of people. But a lot of people, based on who he's, you know, giving information about, are like, this might be Robert Downey Jr. All right, so that's a little background for what I'm about to tell you. I think this episode of television was designed partially as a call out to a really bad guy. And I've never heard that mentioned about the episode, but watching it, I'm like, I really get the sense that that might be what's going on. And I'll tell you why I think that. I'm going to have to, again, being very delicate, I am not saying that I think that this person is a monster. I'm saying this episode was partially based on stories that were going around Hollywood at the time and still are today about this person. And I'm not going to tell the whole story because, again, don't want to get sued. I'm just going to direct everyone to YouTube and Google, and you can decide for yourself. And the clue I had was, in this episode, they mentioned that the guy was a former child star of, based on the fact that the show was called, I think, Don't Miss the Bus or something like that, probably high school themed, right? And here's the thing that's interesting. There is an element that isn't really important to the episode, but is mentioned about his backstory anyway, which is that he was the fat one on the show. Right. And it's partially important to the episode because, you know, she got him to work out and transformed him and they have this weird codependent thing. But I think, right, he could have also been a Screech style, the skinny loser on the show, and she could have got him to eat well and work out and change his image. I think it's important to what they were trying to reference that he was the fat one on the show and now he is a monster. Right, now is he a monster who exploits women? And I'm not going to say the whole thing, but I suspect that what they were referencing, I could be completely wrong. And if I am, I don't want anyone to sue the inside, because I'm not going to say this person's a monster. All I'm going to say is, people listening to this, if you're wondering what I'm going on about, I want you to go to Google. I want you to Google the name Dan Schneider. Right? Google the name Dan Schneider. And then after you've read the first couple of Google results about that name, you can tell me if I'm crazy, right? And if you think I'm crazy after reading the first couple of Google results that come up for Dan Schneider, go for it. But I really think after reading these stories, and you can go and read these Google things between the next episode and this one and tell me if you think I'm crazy, but I suspect that the people working on this show had heard awful Hollywood stories about a child star and worked that into this episode. That is my suspicion, and I want people to know where I suspect the episode was coming from. I think it's worth looking at. I think it's worth discussing, but that's that. All right. So yeah, what I'm saying is I think it came from a real place, a realer place than you might think, an episode about a serial killing for a former child star and the woman he exploits. Well, the woman he exploits is the serial killer. But at the end, he's down for serial killing as well.
Yeah.
He's 100% down for it as well. So it's not like he's innocent in any of this. So yeah, that is my possibly, well, it's not libelous because I have not said anything bad about this person. I have just said, I suspect they were trying to include Hollywood rumors in their show. And I'm telling you to go to Google. And when someone's reputation is such that, like, Google result number two is their name and then the word scandal, I don't think I'm damaging their reputation at all by telling you to go to Google.
No.
You know, like, I'm not spreading rumors. I'm telling you to go to Google. Google will spread the rumors for me. And that's on. So just Google Dan Schneider and you make up your own mind when you think about this episode. All right. So yeah, I'm just saying, I think it's entirely possible. And again, I could be reading way too much into this.
No, no.
Okay, no, I just think it's interesting that within the framework of this show, I think it's possible that they were trying to call out actual real life bad behavior.
I wouldn't be surprised.
And if they were, it only makes me respect the show more.
Well, the thing is, well, here, and you're never going to ask anybody about this.
Of course. No, no, no. I mean, were we to interview the writer of this episode, we would not ask about that thing. Because again, that would be asking them to libel themselves, to commit libel, you know? So we're never going to pursue this theory. I'm just saying, I couldn't help in the Me Too era, what we know about what happened to Ileana Douglas and what happened on Action just like 5 years before this was made, it's not crazy to think that other people are hearing these Hollywood stories and wanting to get these Hollywood stories out there in a way that is, you know, palatable to the audience, right? And isn't going to get them fired and sued.
Okay.
And that is my takeaway. All right. So that is the last I'll say about that.
Well, it doesn't have to be, but what I would say is, in many ways, after all, you can couch things. For example, just go and look at, I hate to say it again, read the book, not go and look at, read the book, LA Confidential.
Oh, God, yeah. All the stuff about Disney in there? Oof.
All the stuff in there about the horrible, horrible people. And, if you go back and read, and it's probably, sometimes I think it's why I read so many of these things too, and the detective stories and stuff. You go back and there's all sorts of stuff about Hollywood.
Yep.
And it's not just Hollywood. You go back and read a few of Dashiell Hammett's things.
Oh, God, yeah.
Right? You see, so many of these people were show covered by back in the olden days, and it continues on the studio system. They were so covered. I mean, there's the scandal with little Freddie what's his name? It starts with an A, his last name.
I'm blanking.
No, Freddie, whatever. But you can, anyway, you can get it. Stick Freddy.
Don't get hung up on trying to remember this name. Tell the story.
Okay. So yeah, no, he was a child molester. And, look how Charlie Chaplin was covered up. Yep. I mean, we just screamed about Derek, I think a few episodes ago.
Mm-hmm.
Bringing up Charlie Chaplin. Oh, that was, yeah, never mind. I don't want to go right, but there's those things, but there's like Dashiell Hammett wrote these. And you can read, you have to read between the lines sometimes about what's going on.
Yeah.
Like really read, but I can still remember. And they try and get some of this stuff out because there is no other way to get it out. So you write it, you hide it in your stories. Look at the stories of Raymond Chandler.
Yeah. That's what you were saying.
You know, as well as Dashiell Hammett. And you look at some of these and you look at the in-between stuff and you're just going, I mean, what's in the books is not necessarily what's in the movies. You have to go and read the books to do this. Like, sure, people, this reminds me, right, when I was doing, we were doing something about violence against women and when I was working at ECOS, Research Associates. Right. And I can still remember one of the people talking to me who had been just briefed on all of this stuff and what the importance of this particular study was going to be and blah, 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 blah. And she's telling me these, and I'm just looking at her. And she says, but nobody cared about it in the past. I said, that's not true. Nope. I said, it's not that nobody cared. It's that you couldn't fight, quote, City Hall in many ways.
You couldn't stand up to the man at the time.
You couldn't stand up to the friggin' patriarchy because it was so damn powerful.
Yep.
And, you know, and I said to her, no. I said, let me tell you, I can tell you stories. I said about, so you had Uncle Harry, who when he got drunk, right? So would beat his wife and stuff. So there was a party. So what would you do? You'd make sure, or he'd beat his wife and his kids and everything else. And so what you would do is, okay, so I think Gladys, you're going to come home with me tonight and the kids.
Yeah, because you see he's drinking too much. So, you know, he can't be around his family when he's drunk. You didn't call the cops. You didn't confront him and get him help. You just, when you saw there was a situation, you're like, oh, maybe you come over to your sister's house tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And that was as much as they would do to confront the situation.
Well, but the thing is that it always sounds when you say that was as much as they would do. Well, there wasn't much more because you knew. Well,
yeah, I agree. Like, I mean, legally, yeah. Wives were the property of their husbands. That's not, it sounds absurd to say today.
Yeah.
But that's until very recently, wives were legally the property of their husbands. And it was almost impossible to be convicted for spousal abuse. The damage you had to do to a spouse to get convicted of it is absurd. And it's disgusting, but that's true. Mm-hmm. That's just a fact. Right. And yeah, I mean, historically, and the thing is, I remember this is related to the Weinstein thing. I remember someone trying to, I mean, I'm not going to say who it was because I don't want to, you know, publicly shame them. But it's like was saying about how didn't understand the Bill Cosby thing. And it's like, it just sounds like, you know, it was normal casting couch stuff. And I'm like, do you think the casting couch was ever okay? First off, you're wrong. The Bill Cosby thing is monstrous drugging women. But beyond that, people of a certain age don't want to admit that, like, Bill Cosby was a monster. Like, I don't get it. He's obviously a monster, but people have so much wrapped up in the idea of, okay, I'm going to say it. Passively racist white people have so much wrapped up in the idea that Bill Cosby was, like, the black guy that they could get on board with, that finding out he was a monster has shaken, like, how they think of themselves as nice liberals. But that's not what I'm here to talk about. So his passive use, I gave it away that it was a he, although you probably could have guessed that. His passive use of the defending, like, oh, it's just the casting couch. And it's like giving parts to people because you slept with them, blah, 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 blah. And that's how Marilyn Monroe got started in it. I'm like, okay, sure. But, but the point is, do you think that the women were okay with the casting couch? Do you think the casting couch was the woman's idea? Like, do you think, like, no, there were women for whom, like, literally, it didn't matter if you were talented or not. You wouldn't get a part in X's movies unless you slept with him. There was no opportunity to have a career if you didn't sleep with these men. So the question is, it's like, who benefited from the casting couch? It wasn't the women, you know? The full stop, people who did not deserve the part would get the part if they were willing to sleep with somebody. People who did deserve the part wouldn't get it if they wouldn't sleep with somebody. So who does the casting couch benefit? It sure as hell wasn't benefiting the women.
No.
The casting couch was not manipulative women, like getting one over on men. It was a system of power men used to keep women oppressed. Right? It was one of the many, many arms of the patriarchy. So defending something as just being like the casting couch, no. Things were horrible in the past. They're slightly less horrible now, but only frigging slightly, because is Harvey Weinstein in jail yet? No. Well, only slightly better now, aren't they?
Yeah. In fact, he's making a $44 million deal.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Okay, something like that.
So, that is the thing that sickened me so much when I heard someone comparing something to it. It's like, that's not saying that something is just like the casting couch isn't a good thing. There was never a time where this was acceptable. There was just a time when people didn't talk about it.
Yeah.
It's never been acceptable. It's never been good. People just didn't make a fuss back in the day because you would be blacklisted from the industry.
Yeah.
And as Ileana Douglas proved, you still might get blacklisted from the industry.
Yeah. Oh, no. Oh, no. And as I said, what's her face? Ashley Judd.
Oh, God, what happened to Ashley Judd?
Yeah, losing a major, major, major role.
Major role? Lord of the Rings. She lost Lord of the Rings.
Because of her.
Peter Jackson, it's like, here's the two different parts I think you would be perfect for. Which one would you like to focus on? And then Weinstein comes along and said, you can't hire Ashley Judd. She's crazy. She's unstable. It's going to lead to all sorts of problems in production. Like, that's what Weinstein did. To Ashley Judd, of all people. Oscar-nominated, super famous and rich actress, Ashley Judd, had lost the Lord of the Rings because of that. That's crazy. That's legit madness. But that's happened as little as 10 years ago.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Now I guess we're getting close to 20 years ago. But it's like, this stuff is still happening today. I mean, yeah, now, every now and then, people can speak out of it and something good can happen, but it's still happening today. Only now, we're now largely willing to talk about how horrible it is. But I just, like I said, I can't stand it when people are unwilling to admit that it was horrible back then, too. You know?
Well, you know what's interesting?
What was the famous, possibly apocryphal line from Marilyn Monroe on her nomination, where she was like, "Oh, well, I got a nomination. I guess I'll never have to suck another dick."
Yeah.
Jesus Christ! Wow! I hope that's not apocryphal. I hope she actually said that.
Probably said it. It wasn't like she was stupid. I mean, people.
No, she wasn't. She knew what world she lived in. And it sucked.
Yeah. I'm sitting here, right? And I'm sitting here listening, and I had a class the other night, and we were looking at something or other, and then somebody just said on this, like, there was this, like, looking at these different videos and stuff, and who's on it, and what songs are on it, and things. And somebody, the word Michael Jackson, I just heard it was, and I just looked. I said, we don't play Michael Jackson in this class.
Nope.
I said, we never. I said, if we could, we wouldn't even say his name.
Yeah.
But
the problem is, he's so frigging integral to culture. You have to talk about him, but you don't want to give his people any money, and you don't want to give him, you know, legs.
It is really interesting because I don't think I've even talked about that, but it goes to this point where we're getting off sort of topic, but
we're getting very far. No. But I mean, it's an episode about child. I mean, it's an episode about a child actor in this screwed up situation. And I took us down a rabbit hole, and I apologize for that, but I think we're getting at some interesting stuff here.
Yeah. But it's, as I said, when we talk about cultural moments and things like that, I look at when Michael Jackson died, I said good riddance to bad rubbish on my Facebook page.
Yep.
And,
there were people who were offended by that. You don't have to sugarcoat it.
No kidding. And then do you think he really did it?
Yes. There's no question that he did it.
And I said, well, of course. Well, yeah, but you know, he never was found guilty.
He was found not guilty.
That doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't mean anything.
Of course he did it.
He was rich. And it's like, well, Macaulay Culkin says he never molested him. And I'm like, yeah, Macaulay Culkin was rich and famous.
Yeah.
He only molested kids that he had 100% control over. That's how frigging child molesters work.
That's right. And whose parents wanted their kid to be in the music in the film industry or music industry and stuff. You know, I mean, they prey on not just the children,
the families as well.
Families, and then the families put their children in these horrible, horrible situations. Right?
That moment, I mean, you watched the documentary, right?
The sports guy. I did talk about the sports guy and about the father who, you know, the sports guy in Michigan and the father who kept his daughter.
Yeah.
Going to him and she denied that he had molested, and then it finally all came out. Right? Because you don't want to do this to your blah, 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 your family, and they're your friends. I still remember, you know, we had one of those uncles in our family.
Well, yeah, the Roy Nassar case is so fascinating because the only one he got convicted of was this girl who was quote unquote the family friend, right? Who were friends with his family and over there. And then her parents her father didn't believe her. And like always demanded that they apologize to him for accusing him of this and blah, 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 blah. And then of course it all comes out and the dad kills himself because you kind of have to in that situation when you've made your daughter's life a living hell for more than a decade by not standing up for her when you needed her the most. Yeah. I get why she
needed
himself.
It the most. Yeah.
Yeah. When she needed it the most. Sorry. Yeah. When she needed it the most, you actively made everything worse for more than a decade.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I understand why he did it. And that situation where it's like you watch this and you're like, of course these guys did it. You think 6-year-olds are making this up? Where would they get it from? And the sad part is sometimes, well, I don't know that a 6-year-old has ever made it up, but 6-year-olds have been told to make it up by their parents or police in very unpleasant situations. That we're not going to get into the McMartin trial here.
Yeah.
But every now and then, cops decide to... Let's just say that every now and then, cops decide to frame someone for child molestation, and it doesn't go well for anybody. But that is an incredibly rare thing. You have to default to believing accusers. You just have to.
Yeah, that's it. You have to default to believing unless proved otherwise in these cases. Because you're talking, first of all, you're talking about children.
We're talking about children. They don't know what this stuff is, so how would they make it up?
You know, like, unless their parents have been prepping them all along.
Been specific, and that is what we're talking about, yeah.
Yeah, and they're child molesters, right?
Oh, yeah.
In the end, they themselves then become molesters.
That's what happens. Well, no, and I mean, that's why I love that line where it's like, he's one of, I remember I came across an episode of Criminal Minds recently where it's like, where they go out of their way to say, he's one of the very rare number of molested children that went on to become a child molester. I'm like, yeah, that's true. It is a very small number of molested kids that go on to become child molesters. It's an incredibly small number. Especially given the shockingly high number of molested kids there are out there. Whereas if it was all of them, there would be nothing but child molesters in the world. It'd be like vampires, and they'd be everywhere.
Yeah.
But the fact that it's a very small number doesn't change the fact that if you're molesting kids, it's because you were molested as a kid.
Yeah, and the thing is, the problem is that that was that 1 in 8 reference, right?
Yes.
That he makes. And you talk about it in your blogs,
in my review,
too.
Yeah.
You know, this 1 in 8. Well, even if it's 1 in 8, that means X number, and they molest more than one child. So, you know, you're still dealing with exponential growth. And you're still dealing with a lot of people.
Yeah.
And as far as I'm concerned, 1 is too many. But anyway.
All right. So.
We've gone down a rabbit hole.
We went down a rabbit hole, and I think it's for reasonable reasons. For everyone who is literally just here to talk us, to hear us talk about the plot of The Inside, I'm sorry we went down a 25-minute rabbit hole about the entertainment industry. 30-minute rabbit hole about the entertainment industry.
Why do you think you didn't go into the entertainment industry?
I know. No, absolutely. I get it. Because I had that drive, but you're like, but what do you call it? I had that kind of drive, but it's like, no, like this is a bad situation. These are bad people.
It's just that there were too many of my friends
who knew
and who were
yeah.
in the business as children. Like I had a number of friends who were in the business as children.
And you had heard the stories.
and I knew what had happened to them. And they, it's an exploitive business, and and it's you know, what did I say? Just go. I mean, and oh God Almighty! Anyway,
all right, we're gonna. You know what? We've talked plenty about this industry today.
Let me just say this. I mean, there are lots of people who aren't exploiters and the rest of it. But it's going to be given because so many people just want to be famous, and this is how they get to be famous.
Yeah.
They want to be, they want to matter.
And it's because of, and it's because of the cachet society places on that fame. Right? Well, it's because of the, yeah, it's because of the value that is placed on success in the entertainment industry. Well, I wrote this, movie a couple of years ago, right? And honestly, it was an adaptation. Well, it wasn't an adaptation. It was a, it wasn't my idea. It was based on another movie. So I was essentially hired to rewrite it. And it's weird because it's not like it's adapted from a short or something. It was like, it was already a full movie. They just wanted to make the movie again in English. So, I mean, that's a whole other conversation. But the point is, one of the characters in it is a little girl. And when I was thinking about it, when I was thinking about the writing, I'm like, I was left with this whole being very uncomfortable with the whole idea of child acting and the industry around that.
Yeah.
And it just, it made me uncomfortable in a way to be writing a part for like a 7-year-old to play. Cause that means there's gotta be a 7-year-old getting this part. And I'm like, I worry about 7-year-olds in this industry. And it's like, I trusted all the people involved and I was pretty sure nothing bad was going to happen. But at the same time, and it's like, I didn't have a way to rewrite it to not have a 7-year-old in the movie.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, it's just like you worry about involving kids in this industry. Fun fact, that 7-year-old would later get nominated for a Canada Screen Award for her performance in the movie I wrote. So I was very proud in that moment, yet, you know, it was mixed. The feeling was mixed. Narcissistic pride and also still worried about the industry.
Yeah, well, no, and it's, I can't even say, I mean,
it's tough.
Yeah, as I said, the stories and the stories and the stories and the stories. Yeah, and these people, but to get back to where this started from, is that, yes, sometimes sometimes the stories are hidden, like, mm-hmm. like you're trying to tell a story about what happens. Now people don't necessarily take it seriously, but it's the only way you can get it off your chest. Yeah. And I mean, I go back to Joe Schlesinger, who said, you know, he got a lot of demons off his chest when he wrote 8mm.
Yeah.
So, you know,
Joel Shoemaker, Joel Shoemaker.
Joel Shoemaker, excuse me.
When he directed it, yeah.
8mm, he said he got a lot of his own demons off. Well, okay, you know, yeah, and that just tells you it's, you know, it's because what happens when you don't have royalty, there's a whole sociological construction around sort of the idea that the film industry and movie stars essentially function as royalty for Americans, because they don't have royalty, right?
Well, they don't have an obvious upper class. That's the thing. Like, and America does have a class system, but after the Great Depression, rich people started hiding. And it's true. Like, try to name rich people in America today. It's actually hard to do. Before the Great Depression, man, but the Koch brothers, that's it. But you know what? It's not the Koch brothers promoting themselves.
No.
Before the Great Depression, rich people promoted themselves because they wanted to be the American royalty.
Yeah.
Right? And after the Great Depression, they're like, people might be starting to put us to guillotines if we don't keep our heads down. So rich people in America started keeping their heads down. And so, in a sense, the class system in America is hiding because all of the rich people are actively hiding how wealthy they are. Right? And I mean, until Betsy DeVos happened and, you know, publicly humiliated herself over and over again, right? People didn't know she existed.
No.
You know, like this unbelievably wealth, two unbelievably wealthy families coming together in her, this prince, literally the family name is Prince, marrying into the DeVos family, these ungodly rich people, right? And no one knew who they were. Cause why would you? Right? No. It's not like the Carnegies, you know, it's not like the Rockefellers. Nobody knew who they were. Yeah. And so they all hid. And so what did we do to feed that the sociological need to have this upper class? Well, that's what celebrities started being. Celebrities, there's always been people who were exceptional from celebrity, right? But there would be royalty, there would be upper class, and there would be celebrities, people who did things exceptional. And when we lost the upper class, we started just talking about the celebrities.
Canada still has its royalty, although they want to get rid of it. Some people. And I'm going, no, please. It's really good.
It's honestly kind of safer.
Doesn't really cost us a lot in the big scheme.
Cost us a lot of money. And I think the argument you're making is by having this, you know, clear upper class, this actual literal group of people who are royalty, it keeps us from investing too much in our celebrities and our politicians the way Americans do.
Yeah.
Because we have actual royalty, we can keep that in a safe place.
Yes. And
we
can
we can let Graham Greene be. You know? We can let Patrick McKenna just be a guy who goes to work.
Yeah.
Because we actually have legit royalty if we want to get that fix.
Yes, and it's why Jerry from Sliders.
Jerry O'Connell
is, you know, making a TV show back in Canada, you know.
Yeah.
Escaping Hollywood. I mean, that's why he left. He left his TV series, right?
Yeah, to go and
he's
do
come home. Back to Canada. He's come back to Canada, right? To make this
from time to time.
I don't know what's it called. Harlan. Right. No. He's on. He's actually on
he's on one now.
Yeah. It's the 13th. You didn't know.
I didn't know.
Oh yes, he's back in Canada making. What's it called? Harley. What's his name? Harley something or other.
Know.
It's on CTV or something. It's on.
Well, I say good for
it's
him.
It's got 13 like
episodes or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's what Jason Priestley did too. He's just like, I can't take Hollywood. I'm just going to come back to Canada. I'm going to be a TV star in Canada. And if you're a TV star in Canada, you make decent money. You have a good life and you can still go to the store.
Yeah, you can still go to the store and people might nod at you.
But it's not going to be a big thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like when I was standing, I remember I'm in line for some, I was an extra in a ton of movies, but we're all lined up for, you know, check-in at this thing in Toronto one time. And it's like, and this is how, you know, Canada is so much different. Literally Mike Myers walks by.
Yeah.
And none of us, you know, thought anything of it. Because again, in Canada, Mike Myers is just a guy who lives in Toronto.
Yeah, from him.
In America, you know? He's Austin Powers, and it's a big deal if he goes anywhere. In Toronto, it's just Mike Myers, a guy who lives in Toronto.
Yeah. No, I mean, those things. It's why they come, you know, you should see the raves that people get. Like, some movie just got made in Sault Ste. Marie, right? And, you know, and then all these people are talking about how wonderful it is to be here, right? Because nobody, like my girlfriend, who was it? Not Forrest Whitaker. Danny Glover.
Okay.
Made a movie. They were shooting out in Echo Bay or something. But he was staying in the same hotel that one of my friends was staying in. Right. And she says, but I nodded at him. But, you know, but she just, well, no, I wouldn't want to disturb him.
No, right? he's on his way to lunch. It's fine.
You know, it's like when I stuck, I could tell that story too, right?
Yeah, we'll tell that story another time. But
yeah,
I guess the real message here is Profiling Criminal Minds. Come for reviews of TV shows about profiling. Stay for digressive ruminations about child abuse and the nature of celebrity culture. Is that a new tagline? Is that a new tagline?
Oh, that's a new tagline. Yeah.
All right. I'm going to write that one down.
Write that one down.
I think we finally found our tagline.
Because we don't stop ourselves. Like, it's not like when you do.
No, I mean, we should stop ourselves. But honestly, the thing is, this episode, The Perfect Couple, really did trigger stuff we're concerned about anyway. So I know why it happened. I'm not okay that it happened. And I'm not going to cut any of this out. I should. I'm not going to.
Well, of course
but,
not.
Like, I know why this happened. And the thing is, fundamentally, this is all true stuff we're saying. And I hope we don't get sued for saying any of it.
Well, you know, I don't know that we've named necessarily.
You just named the one name, and again, it's Google who's defaming that guy. It's not me.
I'm going, so, you know, my line is always, so sue me. You really want my little two-bedroom, you can have it.
Take my shack in Northern Ontario.
Yeah,
enjoy.
Take my 1,091 square feet, 1.5 with an add-on kitchen. Take my duplex. That,
all right. You know, we can stop listing all of your assets now.
Well, come on.
Anyway, as usual... I'll stop any more conversation of your assets before you get people too excited. But anyway, as usual, I'm going to recommend that everyone check out the, what do you call it? Everyone, there's plenty to check out. If you want to reach out to us, if you have any comments about, the Inside, which again, if somehow you're listening to this without having watched The Inside on YouTube, go to YouTube and watch all of The Inside. It's incredible. If you like Criminal Minds, you'll love The Inside, unless you're just going for the inappropriate sexual workplace banter of Penelope Garcia and Derek Morgan, in which case there's nothing like that on this show. Thank God. But yes, if you want to comment, if you have a question, if you want to suggest other profiling-related fiction to us, check us out at profilingcriminalminds@gmail.com. If you're listening to this on a podcast app, be sure to give it a rating. She's just laughing hysterically at this point, so I'll wrap this up myself. As always, I want to thank you all for listening. We'll see you back here next Monday for the final episodes of The Inside. And, of course, every Thursday for regular Profiling Criminal Minds Season 6. See you there, but until then, au revoir.
And good evening.
Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.